most of us think about emotions as the result of an experience, right? So somebody cuts you off in the road and you have an immediate emotional reaction, right? Yeah. That's an easy thing to think about. What you think happened is so-and-so cut me off. That triggered an emotion in me. And then I had a physiological response. I got aggression, my dopamine spiked, my cortisol goes up, all of those things. It's actually the other way around. So our brains are prediction machines. And our brains are constantly, because our brain's job is to keep us alive, our brains are constantly evaluating the inputs that are coming in and making, and it's making choices about how to assign resources in our bodies to keep us alive. Now, fight or flight, you know, those kinds of things. Then what it does is it bounces that reaction off of its own experience to predict the outcome. And that's what creates an emotion.
Hey, this is a quick shout out from one of our awesome sponsors. Check this out. Thank you to Tracy down at Tranquil Turn Massage in downtown Coeur d'Alene. Look, my wife and I, we see Tracy and her team every single month for a couples massage, and it is the best thing. Tracy is a master massage specialist and a Hanu Ashiatsu trainer. You need to reach out to Tracy and her team. Make sure that you tell them that I sent you, and you'll get $25 off your next massage. Also, while you're there, check out CDA Brows, Body, and Ink. Make sure to tell Tracy that I sent you, and you'll save $100 on your next tattoo, brows, and plasma tightening services. Michael, you're a husband, you're a father, you're a coach, consultant, entrepreneur, you're a former analyst for the Department of Defense. So much more, man. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
You bet. It's great to be here. I appreciate it. And you forgot Maverick, which is basically sometimes I cause trouble, and we'll talk about that, I guess.
That's awesome. I love it. I love to kick the show off by going back a bit. Like, where did you grow up and what was childhood like for you?
Yeah, I grew up in, I'm here in just outside of Sacramento, Folsom, okay. California, which is where I live now. I grew up in Northern California, primarily born in the Bay Area, lived up out that way as a kid. Seventh grade on was here in the kind of Sacramento area, okay. Left for college and lived in DC and came back as an adult. And, you know, it's interesting coming back to where you grew up. I think it's always such a great reminder of maybe how you're different, you know, and so sure. It's been a great journey to come back, and it's a great place to live. A lot of nature, enough of a city to have good restaurants and close to the, you know, sort of the beach and then close to the mountains. But as a kid, I don't know. I mean, I had a great experience. My parents divorced when I was young, which of course is formative, but I think for all of us, we don't learn to be resilient without opportunities to demonstrate resilience. And, yep. You know, played sports as a kid, played football in high school and college. And that's been a big piece of who I am. And I still coach youth sports, and that's a big piece for me. Mm-hmm. Got a great family, got some siblings, and, you know, had little bumps and bruises, always getting hurt because I'm always pushing boundaries. I think that's probably a theme of my life is, you know, tell me I can't do something and I'll figure out a way to go do it. So, I'm blessed. It's certainly been a good journey.
Come on. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. I grew up in one of those towns where it was like, either you got married and you stayed in town or you got the heck out right after high school. And I was the one who got the heck out, but,
right. Okay.
I was like, I'm not saying, man, I'm out of here. You know,
yeah. You know, it's sort of interesting that you say that, because I think looking back, I have an older daughter. She went to Boise State, and now she lives in Nashville. And I remember telling her, you know, college is about the journey, right? It's about the transition to adulthood. It's about being on your own. It's about doing those things and kind of going away and coming back. And so much of that for me is part of this journey that, I don't know, I've appreciated it more as I get older. I just turned 50 this year, and, you know, it's, I consider myself halfway. I plan to live to be 100. So, you know, barring anything else, but, it's just such a great transformative experience of moving away from your home and either coming back or blazing your own trail.
Totally. I love that. Well, I want to get right into what you do, because I believe there's a lot of companies out there that need your services. But for those who don't know, like, what is it that you help your clients with?
Yeah, most people would recognize what I do in with the phrase change management or organizational transformation. So, you know, I help individuals, teams, companies change. But it, you know, what I do is probably more distinctive in how I do it. You know, I'm a coach. I sort of how I define myself, whether it's a 15-year-old athlete or a 50-year-old executive that's been in the workforce for 30 years, I realize that a couple things. One, the strategies I was using to shift behavior we're really the same no matter my audience. And so this coaching mindset for me was really important. And I don't really do life coaching as much as, I mean, it's sort of part of it, but I use that term as advisor, consultant, sort of someone who professionally pushes you to be the best version of yourself.
Yeah.
The second thing I do that I would say, and I use that term maverick at the beginning of our discussion, I'm a bit of a nonconformist, and you know, I started my company because I felt that the professionalized world of change management wasn't really very effective. Mm-hmm. I had been through many experiences as a consumer of that, and it wasn't working. We weren't really working with people. We weren't doing things that actually change people. We weren't shifting behavior. We weren't working with the neuroscience of how our brains work, the physiology of how our body works, right? I mean, anyone who's listening to this, who's ever tried to change anything, understands it's a difficult process. And so for me, it was about, you know, kind of having a no kidding, no nonsense conversation with clients. So that's a long answer to your question, but yeah, that's what I do, is I help people change, and I do it in ways that are highly personal, highly integrated, highly high touch. It's really about understanding, you know, what's holding you back, whether you're a team, an individual, or an organization, and building the shifts that we need to move forward.
Man, I love that. I mean, even on your website, you talk about these signs of failed change and transformation.
Yeah.
And I've experienced a lot of that through my career over the years.
Yeah.
Can you deep dive into a few of those signs? And where do you see clients struggling the most when you start working with them?
You know, it's funny because I think a lot of this, yes, you know, a lot of this comes out in the word culture sometimes, right? We all experience that, and we all have ways of defining it, but we've all been a part of a team or a company or a group where we just knew something wasn't right, right? And that shows up as people who are disengaged, people who are misaligned, people or teams where, you know, conflict is not productive, meaning it doesn't lead to the next best solution. It actually holds you back. There's confusing guidance, unclear objectives, poor performance, right? I mean, teams and organizations that struggle with culture generally don't have great performance, right? There's this old phrase that culture eats strategy for breakfast if you come from the MBA world. And so we've all felt those feelings of, we're not aligned, we don't trust each other. And if we don't trust each other and we're not aligned, we can't perform at our best. You might perform in spite of those things, but you know, my job is to really understand what's holding you back and close that space between what is our strategy, our objectives, and the actual behaviors we need to get there. And so, you know, I think a lot of times companies struggle with this idea of, this all sounds good on paper until we get the actual humans involved that need to shift and do the work, right? And yeah, you know, so that's really where I spend time, and you know, it's a great part of my job. I mean, I love watching people grow and change and struggle. I'm in it with them, so you know, it's definitely part of the journey.
And you yourself went on your own journey to kind of figure out why people change, and you know, all this, like, what did you learn on that journey, and how was neuroscience of human behavior part of that journey for you?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I you know, I guess I should caveat this with, you know, I'm not a trained physician,
sure,
but we live in the world of unlimited information, right? Mm-hmm. So as a reference to your audience, first of all, if you're not listening to the Huberman Lab podcast, you absolutely should be. And that is a big piece of what started my journey. Mm-hmm. It's like going to medical school in ways that are just really, really impactful. You know, we all have access to just about every clinical study that's ever been done. And, you know, so about 5 years ago, I just started diving into these concepts, right? And many of the things that I got involved with were things that I sort of knew as like an athlete. You know, we learn certain things about repetition, about the value of stress, right? How to think about stress differently, how to leverage stress for performance outcomes, how to think about the process of growth as opposed to just the result of growth. Like, there are things that we learn in, you know, for me in sports, working with the military, that I sort of had an intuitive sense of, but I never had a language for. So part of it was just diving into the research, listening to those kinds of podcasts, talking to other people in the field, and really kind of getting behind the lens of some of these principles that really shape how we are and how we operate. As an example, There's a great book that I just read from a doctor. Her name is Lisa Feldman Barrett. It's this book called How Emotions Are Made. And most of us think about emotions as the result of an experience, right? So somebody cuts you off in the road and you have an immediate emotional reaction, right? Yeah. That's an easy thing to think about. What you think happened is so-and-so cut me off. That triggered an emotion in me. And then I had a physiological response. I got aggression, my dopamine spiked, my cortisol goes up, all of those things. It's actually the other way around. So our brains are prediction machines. And our brains are constantly, because our brain's job is to keep us alive, our brains are constantly evaluating the inputs that are coming in and making choices about how to assign resources in our bodies to keep us alive. Now, fight or flight, you know, those kinds of things. Then what it does is it bounces that reaction off of its own experience to predict the outcome. And that's what creates an emotion.
Okay.
Your emotions are a frame of reference to your own experience, not the experience of others, and the result of how accurate your brain is at predicting the future. That just sort of blew my mind about this idea of like, wow, if I understand that, I can not control it, but I can train it. Right. I can train it in the same way that an athlete maybe trains itself. But if I understand that, then maybe I'm less reactive to the experience that I'm having because it's just my brain referencing itself. Right. So things like that,
yeah,
for me, if I'm working with a team and there's 10 people, what I have to immediately understand is that each of those 10 people are having a different experience. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I can't take the same strategy and apply it to person one and person eight and expect them to just have the same outcome. Right. So things like that were just, they're just principles for me that were just so powerful in redefining and reshaping. If I can understand myself at the microscopic level, well, now that's information I can use in trying to change my own growth path.
Sure. Wow. Transformation.
Here's a coffee that makes you awake, not woke. Blackout Coffee not only supports conservative values, but they also support troops and first responders. They are true patriots. They are the number one freshly roasted coffee in America, made from 100% specialty Arabica coffee beans. Bonus, you get free fast shipping. This stuff is amazing. I've never tasted anything with better quality. So go out and get your daily dose of fuel right now at blackoutcoffee.com.
You talk about on your website, six principles of human transformation.
And yeah.
I always love to ask her, like, with these, like, which one do you feel is priority number one? And then what is step one to really implement that principle?
Wow. One of the phrases I have, it's a great question. And I'm going to give you a half answer, which is, it sort of depends on where to start, because sure, each of us, you know, changes back to the comment I just made about how our brains work, right? Each of us is at a different starting point. What I like to say is, while there's a formula for change is not formulaic, right? Which means I understand the variables, but your perfect combination of variables might be a little different from mine in terms of where we start. That said, I'll give you a couple answers that I think are really, really important. So the first one is shifting environment. So we know evolutionarily and is that our environment is a huge driver of our behavior. James Clear first wrote about a lot of this in Atomic Habits, which many people know about and have referenced. And the idea is, you know, if we were to use the weight loss example, let's say you wanted to change your diet and you hired a nutritionist. The first thing that nutritionist would do would be to come into your house and remove the things that you shouldn't be eating. They would remove them from your physical environment. Now, that's a starting point, right? Which means you could always go buy other stuff. But the first thing that we do is limit access to behaviors that are unproductive, and we create access to behaviors that are productive, right? So, you know, if you want to go for a run in the morning, you know, put your clothes out the night before. These are simple examples of environmental shifts.
Yeah.
When it comes to companies, there's sort of two dimensions of environmental shifts that are important. One is the physical space, right? We all went through COVID. You're in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. I'm in Folsom. We're not even close, right? We have shifted our behavior because of remote working. Mm-hmm. The environment shifted for millions of people overnight, right? That is a great example. And if we look at hybrid working now and the push to like not go back to the office, talk about an environmental shift that was transformational in all of our lives, right? We can't put the genie back in the bottle. So that's a good example of a shift that's pretty substantial.
Yeah.
But there's cultural shifts, there's emotional shifts, right? There's shifts in energy and the feel of a meeting. I'll just tell a small story.
Sure.
Yeah. One of my clients is a nuclear power company, of all places, great people. And they have a daily meeting. And over time, that daily meeting, they have the main table and they had chairs on the outside. And everybody, this is one of the shifts that we identified for them. Everybody sat every day in the same spot. Only the main leaders sat at the main table and everyone else sat on the outside ring. And we decided to run a little experiment. And part of our team that was working with them, the folks came in and they all sat in different spaces. And when people sat on the edge of the room, they said, no, come to the table. And it was an instant trigger. Something is different, right? Mm-hmm. Why are we doing this? What? Something's changed. You used to be over there. Why are you now over here? Because we are visual creatures, environmental signals tell us something's new, right? That is just a hugely impactful way to sort of start the process of change in those kinds of visual signals. And then what they did was they started the meeting by sharing appreciations instead of what's on the agenda. Mm. That's an emotional shift, right? Yeah. Which is, that's new. What am I grateful for today? These are nuclear engineers. This isn't like gratitude is not an experience that they talk about a lot, right? It's like what's going on with the reactor today.
Yeah.
So those are examples of, you know, how to shift environment.
That's huge.
The other one I would say, and let me just go back a second, because I would say that for some people listening to this, they go, what's the big deal, right? Just last night, we had dinner, my family, we all sit in the same spot. I got back late with my son. He was at baseball. We got back and I sat in my daughter's spot. And my wife turned to me and she's like, this is really, what are we doing? Like, this is weird. You're supposed to be over there, right? And it just changed it. Like, it's incredibly impactful, right? Small changes are hugely impactful. The other one I would say is a really important shift, particularly for companies, is this idea of readiness. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're not too far from the beginning of the new year, right? We've all made New Year's resolutions.
Yeah.
We make them for a while. And then January 19th actually is the most common day that people give up on their New Year's resolutions. But we often wait for moments to get started. We try to prepare ourselves in all sorts of ways. It actually turns out the best thing you can do is just start, right? So what that does is because we learn from failure, right? Physiologically, if I set every one of your listeners up on a dartboard and they threw a dart and all of them hit the bullseye, their next throw would be statistically farther away from that bullseye than if their first throw was a miss. Because your brain doesn't remember successes. It knows that when I failed, I need to autocorrect and adjust. Okay. So rather than focus on getting ready, take an action and learn from that action and then adjust your behavior accordingly. And we spend way too much time staring at problems instead of experimenting with solutions, right? And so those are two big things that they're sort of like some of the best places to start with most big companies. Sorry, there was a long answer, but that's kind of way to think about it.
No, that was amazing. I mean, I love that. And you know, it's funny, my wife and I and our kids, we sit in the exact same spot every night for dinner. So I'm going to go down and change the seat tonight, man, because that's awesome. So good, dude. You know, to open up meeting with gratitude, man. I mean, I look back at all the meetings I've had. I don't think I've ever even had a meeting where even gratitude came up at all. You know, but to start off with that, man, what a game changer there. That's huge.
Yeah. They had a, you can imagine in this environment, safety is a huge issue, right? And for good reason, right? Yeah. And so there's procedures for everything. And again, for good reason, right? You've got to have a checklist. You've got to make sure things are double and triple checked. We had a conversation once and we were talking about this. And I said, just remember, there is no checklist or procedure that will ever change your responsibility to interact with another person, right?
Yeah.
There's no checklist that you could use that can guarantee the person on that other side is having a positive experience. You're just treating them like a checklist, right? And so that was another example of this environmental shift, which is have a procedure in your mind for how to interact with someone in a human way, right?
Yeah.
As opposed to what do we have to get done today, right? Those are just ways to think about behavior shifts that are really, really impactful.
Mm-hmm. you used one of the words as you're talking there about failure, and failure is one of those three F's that you talk about of learning, right? And I saw this on your blog post, and man, it hit home with me. I was like, dang, man. But why are those three F words so important there?
Yeah. So if you haven't seen the post, right? So it's frequency, failure, and feedback, right?
Yeah.
So I'll lean on a neuroscience principle for just a moment. So about over the age of 25, it's not a hard line, right? But our brains shift in some pretty important ways. So up until that point, particularly when we're young, we learn through neurogenesis, right? Which is the creation of new neurons and neural pathways. It's why teaching a foreign language to a toddler is so much easier than teaching it to somebody my age, right? I mean, I speak Spanish and English, but if I tried to learn German right now, I would really struggle because my brain is sort of, it's not fixed, it's highly adaptable, but it's sort of adaptable in a different way.
Sure.
So we learn in one of three ways, generally speaking. So through neurogenesis, which is the creation of new neurons, happens billions of times when we're babies and toddlers and young people. After that, it happens by either strengthening the pathways we already have or weakening the pathways we already have, right? So there's fancy terms for that, long-term potentiation or long-term depression. And what it means is the more I do something, the stronger that pathway gets. So from a frequency perspective, I have to repeat an action several times, many times, right? If I wanted to teach you to learn a tennis ball or to serve a tennis ball, you wouldn't learn that by reading about it. You'd learn that by doing it, right? Yeah. And you'd have to do it over and over and over again, because you would be strengthening the neural pathway that says Eric needs to take a piece of his brain that was previously dedicated to something else and recommit that to serving a tennis ball.
Yeah.
We just talked about failure, right? So the more you hit the net, the more you learn that the action that you just took is ineffective, right? It's sort of like golf. I don't really play golf, but my first golf shot is incredible. Every shot after that is terrible, right? Because I'm just not very good, right? But I need to frequently do something, and then I need to fail at it. But what's important with failure is I need feedback, right? And that feedback needs to come from two sources, sort of internal feedback, but then external feedback, right? And that this is why coaching for me is still just the lost art of growing effective humans, is because somebody needs to say, what did you learn? How did you adjust? Try this again, do that. You could have put your foot here. You could have done whatever. And where most people, I think, misapply these lessons is that we don't think about this from behavior, right? If you want to be more patient, you have to practice being patient, and then you have to kind of suck at it. And somebody has to tell you how to get better, right? Like behavior is the same way, right? I think you've been doing the push-up challenge. I see you on Instagram doing it all the time, right?
Yeah.
Right? Did you do 100 push-ups the first day? No, right? You had to build up through that behavior over time.
Yeah.
And our interactions with other people are exactly the same way. And honestly, it's why I have a job, because we too often just expect people to get it, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, you went to that, you know, you watched that 30-minute video on how to be more inclusive. Are you done yet? Well, no, it's a process, right?
Right. Yeah. Man, that's huge. And so important when it comes to the coaching side of things. And I coach baseball. I've coached it now for the last, you know, 5 years. And of course the age group is a little bit smaller, you know, than 10-year-old, 11-year-olds right now, but it's so important to work that frequency in there, get that failure, get them feeling that, hey, you know what? I didn't do well that time. Let's adjust this. Right.
Right.
You know, it's so important on that. I knew I was in trouble a couple years ago. And very first practice, I asked a bunch of 9-year-olds, I said, all right, who's got their cup on? And two kids raised their hand. And I said, yeah. And they said, what's a cup on? And I said, we are screwed this season, man. They don't even, you know.
Well, you know, unfortunately, learning that the hard way is a very, very difficult experience. So,
absolutely.
You know, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm a big music guy. So I'm asked to finish, I like to finish the show off with a fun question. Like, what type of music do you listen to? Or do you have a favorite band that you like to listen to?
I play the drums. Okay, cool. I played the drums from when I was a little kid. I am not as much of a drummer as I used to be, but as my mom would remind me and my brother, my older brother played as well. Every one of her Tupperware bowls had been beaten in by drumsticks when we were in elementary school. I really have quite a range, actually. Yeah. I love to dance. I love R&B music. I love hip hop music. I love country music. I love my guilty pleasures, like yacht rock radio is okay. One of my favorite things in the world. It reminds me of being a kid in the back of my mom's station wagon before we had to wear seatbelts, and I could just sit there and be like, I mean, this is not safe at all.
Sure.
It just kind of depends on my mood. I love EDM. I love electronic music. Kind of depends on what I'm doing.
Yeah.
What's your sort of favorite genre?
You know, I'm a rock at heart. I grew up going to rock shows. My first rock concert was Richard Marx. My dad took me to Rod Stewart when I was 13, you know, and I've seen, I worked in Universal Records for a long time, and I was straight metalhead for a really long time. And then when I went to work for Universal Records, I said, you actually have to listen to other kinds of music if you're going to work here, right? So I kind of opened my eyes to more hip hop and country and things like that. So I am all over the place now, but I think True Heart sticks with the rock there, you know, I had the
long hair.
There's
definitely you know, as a drummer, the first song I learned to play on a drum set was Sussudio from Phil Collins,
which is,
you know, a pretty good song to play.
Sure.
And I love listening to that music to play the drums too. But and so it's just interesting, you know, your mood kind of dictates what you want to be kind of doing. But my wife has told me I need to get a drum set again. So that might be in my future here.
Come on. Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. Michael, this was such an amazing show, man. You dropped so much knowledge, dude. You are an absolute world changer. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day, man. I appreciate you.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on, Eric.
Hey, if you've ever thought about starting a podcast but unsure where to go, you need to go check out ericallenmedia.com. Click on the resources tab there. I will walk you through how to start, launch, and run a podcast. I've recorded over 500 interviews since 2017, and I want to help you launch your podcast. Make sure that you hit that subscribe button so you catch every show when I drop them. Thanks again. Keep changing the world.